Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm Travis Hornsby, and boy oh boy, do y'all have some questions for today's episode. Today's episode is a little bit odd because it's a St. Louis themed episode to the extent that my analogies don't make sense. I apologize, but first we're going to start off today's episode by answering some listener questions. And if you're like, oh my gosh, I wish Travis would answer some of my questions, well, guess what? You can do that. Just go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail and then press a record button on your Android or iPhone and just speak into for like 30 seconds or a minute or something, whatever questions you've got. And we love featuring those on today's show. So first, we have a question about PSLF.
Hi, Travis. Last month, I asked you a question about public service loan forgiveness. My eligibility is in July, and that's when I'll apply. But do I need to be employed at a nonprofit at the time of forgiveness? Currently, you mentioned the answer is yes, but when will that change? What kind of information do we have now?
Good question. We're expecting at some point that this sort of somewhat archaic requirement that you're employed full-time at a qualifying employer to get PSLF when you submit your final application, we think at some point that's going to be dropped. But if you look at the official federal website, currently you do still have to be employed at an actual place that qualifies for PSLF at the time when you submit the final application. So specifically, the question on the PSLF Federal Student Aid website says, when I'm ready to submit my forgiveness forms, do I need to submit any other documents to the PSLF servicer? And it says, yes, even if you submitted forms during the entire 120 qualifying payments, you will need to show that you are employed full-time at the qualifying employer at the time you submit your final PSLF form. So it's pretty clear, directly implied, that you have to be fully employed full-time at a qualifying 501c3 or government employer to get PSLF when you submit your final application. Now, once you've submitted that application, if you can prove that you were employed at that time at a qualifying employer, at that point, you can do whatever you want. You could quit your job and you could wait around until you get forgiveness if you're positive that you qualify. But, you know, we'll see a lot of changes, I predict, under the Biden administration with PSLF. A lot of it's probably going to be bureaucratic changes where it's going to side on the side of helping people qualify more easily. So, for example, we saw that change already with PSLF where employers can make lump sum contributions and have that count for multiple months of payments. We saw that change, and that was just a random bureaucratic rule change, right? So I anticipate that we're going to see more of that kind of thing. So now a second question about the nature of furlough counting for loan forgiveness.
Hey, Travis, I have a couple of questions I was hoping you might be able to help with. My first question is regarding loan consolidation and PSLF. When I graduated from medical school back in 2012, I consolidated my loans because I had some non-direct loans and planned to pursue PSLF, which I am now working toward. My loans were consolidated into a subsidized portion and an unsubsidized portion, which I think is typical, but I didn't realize until recently that each portion has a different disbursement date, with the subsidized portion being disbursed about 6 months later than the unsubsidized portion. As a result of this difference, the 6 payments I made during that initial time period only counted toward the unsubsidized portion, and I now have a 6 payment discrepancy between the two loans, meaning I will have to make an extra 6 months of payments before my subsidized portion reaches forgiveness. It was quite a long time ago, but I don't seem to remember submitting 2 different consolidation requests that would have led to 2 separate consolidation dates. As someone who looks at a lot of student loans, does this scenario make sense to you, or was there likely some sort of processing error on my loan consolidation that caused this discrepancy? If there is an error, do I have any recourse here, or am I just going to be stuck making those extra 6 payments? I tried calling FedLoan about this, but they weren't very helpful, and I can't seem to find any of the old consolidation-related documents to clarify what happened. My second question is related to tax filing status and IDR plans. My wife is also a physician with a large student loan balance on income-based repayment. For the past few years, she has cut back her hours to be part-time in order to stay home with our young kids, so her income has dropped substantially. Based on my estimates from using some online calculators, it seems that filing taxes separately will save us money because the reduction in her student loan payments will more than offset the extra income taxes we will pay by doing so, particularly once my loans are forgiven and no longer included in the calculation for her payments. We were planning to file our 2020 taxes separately, but now that President Biden has extended the pause on student loan payments through at least September of 2021, we won't be saving enough on the remaining payments to make up for the extra taxes paid by filing separately this year. Instead, I would prefer to wait until tax year 2021 to file separately. So my question is this: if we file taxes jointly for tax year 2020, must that tax filing status be used when recertifying our IDR plans during 2021, or is there a way to recertify based on our intended filing status for tax year 2021? I don't want to be stuck making an entire year of higher student loan payments because I made a mistake on filing my taxes. Thanks for your help.
Another really good question. Y'all are really challenging me today with my PSLF knowledge. If you look at the actual PSLF form, I think it's important to look at it and read what the definition says. So if you look at what is qualifying for full-time, it says full-time means working for one or more qualifying employers for the greater of an annual average of at least 30 hours a week, or for a contractual or employment period of at least 8 months, an average of 30 hours per week. What's interesting about what they said is the listener said that she'd been furloughed for several months during the pandemic, but the contract specifically says for PSLF, it says at least 8 months. That specifically was written into the PSLF program to make sure that teachers could qualify for, you know, 12 months a year instead of the amount of time that they would be employed. That was kind of the original idea behind having that stipulation in there. So it's pretty clear just based off of the PSLF certification form language, it says contractual or employment period of at least 8 months. So when you're furloughed, you're not laid off. You're still an employee technically. My own brother went through this with Disney and he was an employee of Disney even when he was unemployed for several months because they were at least providing health insurance and some other things. A furlough is not the same thing as being laid off. A furlough is sort of this temporary status where you're going to be called back and your contract wasn't canceled during that time. So I'm not surprised that they gave credit to this listener for PSLF during these several months being off. So that's great news for this listener. I think that you can feel calm and assured that this payment credit during this period will count for your public service loan forgiveness credit. So pretty exciting. And now a question about different disbursement dates and just qualifying credit more generally for forgiveness, as well as a question about tax filing status with the latest extension of the interest freeze from President Biden.
Hey, Travis and team. My name is Jillian, and I'm a physical therapist from the Bay Area. I have been working full-time for about 4 years for a nonprofit working towards public service loan forgiveness. And when COVID hit, I was furloughed from my job for about 4.5 months. So when I went to go resubmit my public service loan forgiveness paperwork this time around, I included a signed letter from my boss saying that. And I received the verification back, and it looks like they counted those months towards public service loan forgiveness. So I guess my question to you is that set in stone? Obviously, I was truthful on the paperwork, so I don't know. Is, you know, when I go in 6 years to hopefully get my loans discharged, is there going to be an issue? Or since I have that letter, do you think that I'm good for those 4 or 5 months? Thank you very much. Sorry for the kid in the background.
So for the first question, is it normal? Do you have any recourse if you have a few loans that have, you know, a couple extra months of credit because of them entering repayment sooner than the other ones? And the answer is generally no, you don't. This is why we tell people that the best time to get student loan help is basically as soon as possible. You can always fix things like from a look forward basis, but you know, a lot of times when things happen in the past, you can't change them and reverse the lost savings that resulted, right? So in this particular case, you can save some money for the future. What I would specifically ask this person is, are you on a payment plan that will be capped in its monthly payment? So specifically, pay as you earn and income-based repayment are two of the programs that cap your monthly payment at the standard tenure. Well, what's really helpful about that is if you have a lot of your loans forgiven and you only have a few left that you have to make 6 monthly payments on, say you had to recertify on only those few loans. Well, if you were on something like the revised pay-as-you-earn plan, your payment would still be 10% of your income and you would get substantially less forgiven. Now, if you consider pay-as-you-earn or income-based repayment, let's say that you had everything forgiven, but let's say there's only $20,000 of loans left. The standard 10-year plan for about $20,000 of loans is about $200 a month. So for those six additional months of payments, you could pay $200 a month instead of, let's say, a doctor's revised pay-as-you-earn payment, which could be $4,000 a month for a couple. So that could result in you receiving substantially the whole thing forgiven almost versus you basically having to pay the entire thing back. So there's still a lot of really smart planning that can be done if your dates for the payment count don't quite match up. What we do when we're doing consults for our clients is we go into the NSLDS files that they send us, and we have a program, a proprietary program we use that pulls out all of the information that we want to see. And then we can look at the payment history literally from the very beginning of when your loan was disbursed, and we can see what you're being given credit for. And a lot of times it's really rewarding to be able to tell someone, hey, you know, you have X amount of forbearances and deferments, and you can literally manually count it if you want, to show exactly how much credit you should have towards different forgiveness programs. And then you're an informed consumer, right? Then when you have conversations with FedLoan, instead of wasting your time bashing your head against the wall, you know, you have a lot more clearly outlined setup going on with where you're the person that knows more in the situation, which is always a good thing to be in, good situation to be in. Now, the second question was about tax filing status. And I predict we're going to get this question thousands of times, probably between now and when student loan payments start up again. So initially, servicers were giving us the guidance that you have to certify, but if your certification date is between January and March of 2021, then we're going to kick that out later to 2022 for people with certification dates between January and March. So theoretically, that means that if your certification date is somewhere in January, February, or March every year, then it kind of depends on how fast you expect you're going to have your tax return ready in 2022. If you think you're going to have your tax return ready right away, then, you know, say you're, for example, you've been notified by your servicer that your certification date's going to be March of 2022, and you verified that, which we can do for clients in the NSLDS tool that we have. So if you verified that, then you can see exactly when your next certification is due. And so if it says March 2022, which is literally something that the servicers are just kind of figuring out on the fly, but if they say that's when it's due, then yes, you could file 2020 taxes jointly, and you could wait until 2021 taxes to file separately. Now, we personally like a more, shall we say, complicated strategy than that, just to be extra safe. You can amend taxes from separate to joint up to 3 years in the past. You do not want to file separately and then immediately amend your return right after you've given your loan servicer you're filing separate information, because that makes it look like you did what you did solely because of student loans and no other reason. Now, you could say, well, it's pretty obvious that even if you wait to change your tax status from separate to joint, you'll still be doing it for student loan purposes. So isn't that fraudulent? The reality is this. It's a gray area, but we feel quite confident in people filing taxes separately, using that return for their student loans, waiting for a full year until their next certification is due. Then they have to use a new tax return that shows married filing separately. And then and only then are you allowed to go back and amend old returns from separate to joint and get any associated penalties on the federal level back as a refund. We had this case recently. I'll just tell you a case without giving any identifiable information. We had a case where someone was making, say, $0 to $30,000, quite low income, married to someone making a couple hundred thousand dollars. And the penalty for filing separate was going to be around $8,000 to $15,000 a year, and that was a big hit. So what I would advise that couple is, with all this uncertainty around the student loans, you don't want to be stuck with a $1,500 a month payment when your payment could have been based on that $20,000 income earner paying almost nothing. And so what you can do is file separately if you can afford to take that upfront $8,000 to $15,000 hit, and then you can amend that tax return come, let's say, March of 2022, if that happens to be your recertification date. You file separately for 2021 taxes, you use them for your recertification in March of 2022, and then you can go back and amend 2020 from separate to joint and get that money back as a refund. That's a really complicated strategy, but it's something that personally we would recommend to couples if they can afford to take that hit on their taxes up front, because you're allowed to file separate and then amend to joint up to 3 years in the past. And that is a wonderful tool for kind of correcting some of the problems with the student loan program where they're trying to get you to include your spouse's income, but you know, you really want to do it, but you don't want to break the rules. I mean, the thing is, you know, a lot of people with the loan servicing companies will tell you, well, go ahead and check that my spouse won't give me their income information. Well, that's ridiculous because most people have joint bank accounts with their spouses. And if you're filing, you know, if you check that box, you can't access your spouse's income information. And literally your spouse's paycheck is deposited in the same account. Well, that's just not very smart if the program's ever audited. If the program's ever audited and they say, well, why were you amending your tax return every single year? Now, don't get me wrong. We don't like that strategy necessarily for 20 years. Like amending your tax returns every single year with a 1 or 2 year lag sounds like a big pain in the butt. What you'll generally find is the need to amend tax returns is generally a pretty short duration. Because usually what happens is if both people have student loan debt, then the person who's the low-income spouse is low-income for a particular period or season of life. For example, maybe you have young children and one spouse has decided to stay more limited in their work hours to try to spend more time with the kids. Well, that income's going to jump back up, and then filing separately might not cost you $15,000 anymore. Maybe it'll only cost you $1,000, and then it's not even worth the tax prep fees to fix that. So there's all kinds of stuff that goes into making a student loan plan. And it's something that we've developed over like 5,000 different times of doing this. So, I mean, it's a complex situation, but what we would probably suggest to someone who's trying to navigate this is if you really cannot afford to file separately, because that would represent such a big hit, and you have verified with your servicer that your certification date is going to be sometime in 2022, then if you feel like you're going to have your 2021 tax return ready, then go ahead and file joint for 2020, and then you can do separate for 2021 and use that tax return later. But again, if you can afford to take the hit in 2020, we'd say file separate if you think that it would benefit you, and then we can readjust and sort of reassess later and do an amendment for the tax return and get that money back. So that's one of the reasons we started working with a tax firm that knows how to do this. Reach out if you need any intros there. Really good questions. Wow. Y'all really like to get technical, don't you? It can be about more than just student loans, too, if you want to ask about what the heck happened with the whole GameStop and AMC sort of Reddit trading controversy and the Robinhood stuff. Like, feel free to ask about other things besides just student loans, although I know that you listen to this podcast primarily for the student loan stuff. So now the main topic of today's episode, we're going to just talk through kind of a topic that I've been thinking about quite a lot lately. Some of you know that I live in St. Louis, Missouri. In St. Louis, Missouri, we invented Budweiser. I think the story goes that Adolphus Busch maybe married into some beer family. I don't know. I'm really butchering the family history of Budweiser. But basically, St. Louis, Missouri had all these caves, I think, that were pretty cold temperatures that would allow people to naturally store beer at refrigerated temperatures back in the 1800s when it was kind of difficult to do that. And so St. Louis, Missouri became this huge beer mecca. And there's all kinds of breweries, some obviously very active, like the Budweiser original brewery, and then some other ones that are just kind of weird and creepy and don't really operate anymore. It's such a fascinating history of the beer industry in St. Louis. And one of the things about the Budweiser brewing complex is at some point they started advertising using Clydesdales. Clydesdales, if you've never seen them before, Google them. They're really fascinating. Clydesdales are a type of horse. I don't know when exactly Budweiser started using Clydesdales in their marketing. I think it must have been around Prohibition or something like that, because they, when Prohibition happened, the company obviously was hurt pretty bad, and so they took their products and made it, I think, baking yeast, and then Prohibition ended, and I believe they sent a cart fully loaded with Budweiser to Congress so the members who voted for the repeal of Prohibition could enjoy some of their product. Talk about some wonderful marketing strategies. So anyways, these Clydesdale horses are massive. I remember seeing them as a kid, and these Clydesdale horses were just way taller than, like, I felt like a basketball player even, like so tall, so powerful and muscular. And, you know, these horses were chosen by Budweiser because they can literally pull a barn. These things are just pure muscle and they weigh a ton. So Clydesdales are probably the most powerful of all of the horse breeds out there. And, you know, forgive me, please, our veterinarian listeners, you're listening to me describe this and you're like, oh my gosh, this guy is really painful to listen to. I will defer to you. I apologize in advance. This is a casual person talking about the Clydesdale here. But I promise this has a point with student loans. And the reason is that, forgive the analogy, but you are a Clydesdale. You are extremely powerful. You have more power than you could believe with your abilities as a professional, and you have more power than you would believe financially for your future and your security for your family. And the reason is because Clydesdales have the most power, so they can also carry the heaviest load. And this is going to sound strange, but you're a Clydesdale and not a pony. What can ponies carry? Ponies are pretty small. They're generally at kids' birthday parties, and they're a big hit when you bring out the pony, but ponies can barely carry anything. So I want you to think about different kinds of degrees out there. So you have associate degrees, right? You have folks that don't even finish college. You have four-year degrees, bachelor's type degrees, and then you have your master's degrees, and then you have the professional and doctoral level degrees, which are the most intense, right? And a lot of you listening, probably most of you have those graduate degrees. So, you know, you might look at a traditional debt repayment metric and you might say, well, okay, does being a dentist make sense if I have $600,000 of debt, but I'm only earning $120,000? Now you might say, well, shoot, there's no way that I can afford to pay $5,000 a month. I made a bad decision. I should have just been a bachelor's degree holder and then I would be so happy and it would be really straightforward and I wouldn't have this big debt hanging over my head. And then I'd be listening to true crime right now instead of Travis ramble on about weird analogies with student loans. The reason why you're a Clydesdale, not a pony when it comes to your finances is student loans, the worst case scenario is that $600,000 debt or whatever you have, that is a income tax worst case. Now, if it's a private loan, you do have to pay it back. Then it is debt. Then all the traditional rules apply. But if we're just talking about federal student loans, it is a percentage of your income. Generally speaking, that percentage is anywhere from 6% of your income to 9% of your income, just analyzing it, just you at an individual level. Why is that? It's because over the long run, you get a deduction before they take 10% of your income. On your taxes, you get a standard deduction. It's about $12,000. So you can earn up to $12,000 a year and pay 0% in federal income tax. That's because you get a standard deduction, which is what they give you before they take any income tax. They only take income tax on the amount above that. So the same thing is true for student loans, but except instead of using the standard deduction, which would be way too easy, right? I mean, that's just way too simple to use that. They decided to use the federal poverty line. And it kind of makes sense because the federal poverty line is based off of how many people are in your family. The smaller the family size, the lower the federal poverty line, and the larger the family size, the larger it is. That's the deduction you get before they take 10% of your income. So if you think about a family size of one, that deduction is around $18,000. That's the amount of income you get to earn before you lose 10% of your income. So someone that's making $50,000 would lose 10% of $50,000 minus the 18 times 10%. It's about $3,200 a year. So that annual payment, you can split it up monthly, but that $3,200 payment on a $50,000 income might represent about 6% of your income long term. Now, if you're making $200,000 a year as a single person, that $18,000 deduction is a relatively small share of your total income. So that's why they're going to take 10% of almost all of your income. And so then your income-based tax, if you will, is pretty close to that 9% number. It's almost 10%. And obviously, if you were making $500,000 a year as a single person, then your income-driven repayment amount would be almost 10% of your income. But for most people, you're basically paying long-term a 6 to 9% direct tax, basically an income tax, in exchange for the government covering the full cost of your education. Now, why is it not that simple? Well, it's because we have taxes on their forgiven balance. So for PSLF, it's extremely straightforward. Not, you know, the strategy behind it, of course, but it's extremely straightforward that it's an income tax because there's no taxes in the forgiven balance. And so you can calculate what your payment is and translate that into a percentage of your taxable income. And you can say, wow, this is really literally an income tax for 10 years in exchange for me getting my medical degree or law degree or whatever degree you got. That's a great trade. Imagine being a nurse practitioner with a 6 to 9% income tax in exchange for your degree completely paid for. Okay, most people would agree to that in a second. You know, very few people ever worry about an income tax below 10%. You don't see anybody having mental health crises over income taxes. That basically doesn't happen, right? If it does happen, please reach out. We would love to feature you in some sort of story. That'd be pretty fascinating. But, you know, people get extreme stress over debt. The income tax really isn't super stressful unless you're really wealthy, right? I guess maybe then it'd be pretty stressful, right? Elon's probably really sweating right now about what they might do taxing unrealized capital gains. Oh boy. But if you think about this as an income tax, it's also an income tax for people that are in the private sector, not just PSLF. And the reason is because you have to save a specific amount of money in the brokerage account each month. And you can think of that as $500 a month or $1,000 a month or some specific dollar amount. Or you can think about that as a percentage of your income. I would say for most people, that percentage of their income they need to save is somewhere between 1% and 4%. Now, if you have a huge amount of debt and a very low income, then that percentage of your income that needs to go into a brokerage account to cover the future taxes with forgiveness for the 20 and 25 year forgiveness programs, that's generally closer to maybe 10% of your income. But then if your income is that modest, generally that percentage of your income that's required to go to loans is pretty low. It's more like that 6% number. By and large, what we generally see is the total percent that's required to go to someone's student loans is going to be somewhere between, the maximum is around 16%, but I would say that probably the average is around 8% of their income after that deduction that I mentioned. It might be confusing, but that's the 8% number is kind of like 10% of the income above whatever, but you got a big deduction. So if you take the amount of payments divided by your actual salary, it works out to more like 8% effective versus a 10% marginal rate, if you think about it like that. 8% is more typical, and I think 4% is more typical for the amount going for the tax bomb. So I would say somewhere between, like if it's PSLF, it can be as low as 6%, that which is an income tax in exchange for your educational debt being covered completely, right? And then worst case scenario, if you're doing the payments plus the tax bomb and you don't make a lot of money, worst case scenario, you could be looking at like a 16% tax on your income for forgiveness. So here's the analogy. Here's why I talk so much about Clydesdales, you weirdo, Travis. So your student debt, if it's federal, worst case scenario is a 6 to 16% income tax. So let's readdress that dentist. That dentist with $120,000 income is losing 16% of her income, worst case scenario. That's absolute worst case scenario. It's probably lower than that. And it could be lower by filing taxes the right way, by saving for retirement, you could get that number down, by investing in low fee investment brokerage firms that actually have to put clients first, you could get that number down because you won't lose as much to fees. If you know how to invest in general, you'll not have to save as much because you won't have to put it in the bank. You'll be able to get some lift going on for the stock market, helping lift up that savings, not just having to do it brute force. So that dentist, worst case scenario, you know, 16% of 120,000, I could do that if I broke out my calculator or if I broke out my handy pen and paper, but let's say 15% to keep my math easier. So that's $12,000 plus $6,000. So it's $18,000 worst case scenario that's going to her student loans, which means she has $102,000 left over that is not spoken for by either the tax bomb or her IDR payment. So let me ask you this. If you were going to go work for some boring corporation and make $50,000 to $60,000 a year, and you had $30,000 of student loan debt, okay, would you rather have that be the situation, or would you rather have the $102,000 income with zero student loan debt? That is exactly what is going on here. If you have that bachelor's degree, you might be a pony, whereas if you have that professional level degree, you might be a Clydesdale, because the Clydesdale has the most power to handle the debt load that it is put under, because it has the most powerful muscles of all of the horse breeds out there. And, you know, a Clydesdale having to face this level of burden, right? It's kind of a weird analogy in some regards, but I think it's really helpful because it shows you that you're a lot more powerful than you think you are. You are underestimating your ability to handle the load of student loan debt long-term because our student loan system literally is an income tax you can buy your way out of. It's an income tax because worst case scenario, it's 6 to 16% of your income total for the tax bomb and the IDR payments. And it can actually be made a lot lower than that if you have smart planning with somebody that knows what they're doing, like a company like ours. So you can get that number down to the minimal amount possible, and then you're just looking at simply taking off 6 to 16% of your earnings as a graduate degree professional, and then you're comparing those net earnings after completely accounting for student loans, and now you're saying, how does that compare to your bachelor's degree lifestyle and what you earn doing that? Now, in some rare cases, a bachelor's degree holder would earn more than somebody making a professional degree. I would call that dumb luck. Probably if I'd gone on to get a graduate level degree, I actually maybe might earn less than with my bachelor's degree because I like finance and focusing in that world, and that world rewards getting involved in finance as fast as possible, right? So it's not a perfect analogy, but I will say that most people, you know, are not looking to have their job just define them, right? Most people work because they enjoy the job, they find meaning in it, but they also find meaning in other things, like being around family, like traveling when the heck that's allowed again, like enjoying cool vacations, like having fun coworkers, having a good social life. Holistic wellness is really important when you figure out what kind of a career makes you happy. What a great situation that this dentist with $600,000 of student loan debt finds herself in, because how many jobs would allow you to work part-time and still earn $60,000 to $100,000 a year? Not many, right? Not many would offer that level of flexibility. And being a dentist, if you don't mind working for corporate, in most areas of the country allows you that flexibility. You can work 3 days a week, you can work 2 days a week if you want, and out-earn most of the people you went to school with that are working 5 days a week with 20 days of paid vacation, when, you know, the paid vacation you can kind of set up for yourself because you have these skills that are such in demand that you're able to set up the kind of lifestyle that you want versus the kind of lifestyle that someone else wants for you. I think this is really exciting as an analogy because it essentially means that, you know, if you're bothered by your student loans and you're just really not doing well mentally over your student loans and you're in California, then move to Nevada, because California takes 10% of your income, just period, forever. And I said your student loans, worst case scenario, were a 6 to 16% income tax. Literally, the effect of you moving from California to Nevada is the same thing as you canceling all of your student loans completely. Because the government paid for your education, the government is getting in exchange a very convoluted percentage of your income for the next 20 years, worst case scenario. That is an income tax. It is only not totally clear to people that it's an income tax because of how convoluted the forgiveness of income-driven repayment really is. But if that was ever canceled, if that was, you know, forgiven debt was no longer taxable income, then it would be extremely evident to people that it's simply a percentage of your income. And then what might happen in the future is reforms might cause your quote-unquote tax rate for your education to go up or go down, depending on who's in charge. So a President Biden might make some reforms that would probably cause that 6 to 16% income tax basically go down, because maybe he increases the deduction you can take by increasing the percentage of the poverty line that you get before having to pay 10% of your income. Maybe a Republican administration or Congress might say, well, let's have you pay 15% of your income instead of 10, or let's eliminate the ability to allow you to exclude your spouse's income from your payment to try to encourage more people to pay back their loans. Now, no proposals have ever proposed kicking people out of programs they're already on. That's a really good thing. That would be totally stunning if something like that were to ever happen. You can never say never because, I mean, you know, who the heck was predicting a 100-year once in 100 years pandemic this year? But it's extremely, extremely unlikely, because every proposal that's ever been proposed about student loans has grandfathered people in on whatever repayment plan they're already on. I mean, this is really quite exciting. I think that, you know, if you are feeling stress or anxiety from your student loans, what is holding you where you are? Could you relocate to get a change of scenery? Could you take a chance in your career and start up a practice, you know, something just a little bit out of the ordinary? You could do that. That's really exciting, to take a risk and take a chance and just try something different if you're really having a hard time during this pandemic. We have some people on our team. We're a virtual team. There's about 20-ish people that work at Student Loan Planner, and some of the people are doing some really cool things right now. Like, we have one team member who's selling her house and buying a van to travel the country with her husband, and that's really exciting. I mean, when are you going to get to do that? And this is a time when you could do that. You could take chances or take risks or do things you might otherwise feel uncomfortable doing, particularly if you have the ability to sort of work remotely and work from anywhere. it's pretty exciting times we're living in. The remote work world is you know, not going to be going away anytime soon. Now, obviously, for a lot of people like my wife, who's a physician, remote work's going to be another few centuries. I don't know. I mean, like the telehealth thing didn't go super well for my wife's older patients. So I think that there's going to be a lot of medical people that are going to be pretty tied down to a specific location for a long time to come. And that's fine. But I want you to realize that your education is actually probably one of the best decisions you've ever made. And you might say, what is this guy on? This sounds like terrible advice. But again, if your student loans are simply an income tax, then would you rather be a pony or would you rather be a Clydesdale? The Clydesdale has the potential to pay off the student loans with that powerful higher income that you're getting from your professional degree. It's not just higher income too, though. It's esteem in society. It is skill level in your job. It's job security. It's insulation from being laid off. It's higher negotiating power. It's being able to be the boss instead of having to take orders. You're the one giving them in a lot of cases. And its impact on people's lives, your impact is magnified because of the importance of the skills that you have and the way that it can change lives. So I know that sometimes you probably feel underappreciated or not appreciated. That's the right word. I mean, we go through that personally sometimes. I would say that 99 out of 100 of our clients are amazing people that we just love helping. And then every now and then you get the one jerk, right? And I know that a lot of our clients share these stories of like veterinarians who get, you know, harassed online, called greedy, you know, because they can't pay the medication out of their own pockets for treating people's pets. And somehow you're greedy because of that, or because you have to pay your staff, right? Physicians who get left bad reviews online, lawyers, same thing. There's always negative people out there that are trying to bring you down. And I think the impact of that during the pandemic, people are just a lot more stressed. I mean, one thing that I've noticed is I think that like some people are going through enormous pain that's unimaginable in a lot of cases. I mean, I lost a family member this year. Maybe you've lost friends or family this year. It's been a really stressful, tough year. And so I hope that you can realize that things are going to get better, and the unemployment rate among professionals now is almost nothing. I don't think that you'll get mad at me for saying that for 95% of our borrowers who have graduate degrees, this student loan payment and interest pause right now is not necessary. I'm not saying it's not appreciated. It's awesome. We're glad for you that you get to enjoy it until September, but thank goodness that we're not in economic conditions where so many people are just like, you know, the unemployment rate's through the roof. People don't have any jobs. You know, if you look at the economic distribution, that's mostly low income and low skill workers and hospitality industry workers that are still impacted by this at this point. Like, we've done a lot of surveys of our audience of when did your income come back and when was it impacted? And there were some professions like dentistry and optometrists that just got destroyed during the pandemic from the shutdowns, from the loss of income because they weren't working at big healthcare systems. But the thing is these impacts were quite temporary, and boy, did the revenues surge back when people came back to doing procedures. We've got a lot of dentists this year, and we're going to do this in a future episode, that literally are on pace to need to abandon forgiveness and go for refinancing because their incomes have soared so much during this pandemic that they think now that there's no way that they're not going to, you know, they're going to be able to actually get forgiveness because their incomes have become so high relative to their debt. And that's a wonderful thing. I'm so happy. And again, you don't have to be a Clydesdale necessarily. I mean, like, if you want to be a social worker because that's your passion and you're not going to make a lot of income from that, what I hope is your superpower is that you love being a social worker more than anything else you could have done. And that, yeah, you might make even less money than you would make as a bachelor's degree holder, and you still lose that 6 to 16% of the income to the student loans. But hopefully your self-realization and your self-actualization, the benefits and the joy you get out of transforming lives, hopefully that was worth the time you spent getting the education, and it's worth the debt, which is really just an income tax. So remember that there's not a lot of people that could go out and make $400,000 a year if they wanted to. A lot of the medical professionals that are listening to this have that potential if they really, really wanted to. You could pick up extra shifts. You could move to the middle of nowhere. You could do a locums job and basically take jobs anywhere that desperately needs people and just move at a moment's notice. You could theoretically hit that level of earnings. And then even if you didn't want to do something that extreme, you could move to most big cities around the country and get a steady job without too much effort with a fairly decent income. And that income in many cases is at least double that of the median household in America. And if you're not making a high income because you're doing one of these servant, public servant type jobs, right? You're teaching, you're social work, you're mental health counselor, you are, you know, in just a lower income field, but that's so, so important to society, then paying your income tax for this education means that you get to be someone who changes lives and still is able to make a good enough living to, you know, have a good life, right? Cover the basic needs. And if you aren't happy in your current job, guess what? You can go back to work and retrain in a different field, take out additional debt, and it's the same percentage of your income regardless, even if you take out, you know, amounts of debt for 2 degrees. I know because we've had a lot of clients that are chiropractor to nurses or nurse practitioners to lawyers. Actually, we usually have it going to nurse practitioners, not away from. But a lot of people that were in different fields, they just didn't end up jiving with them, and they decided to go back to school and take on an additional $200,000 of debt, and they come out with $500,000 or $600,000 or $700,000. And is that the best strategy from a taxpayer perspective? I don't know. I mean, you know, obviously the people that are doing this are taxpayers too. You know, so is that the most efficient student loan policy? I guess not, but it's allowed. And so if you're miserable in your job, what better time to go back and get another degree than right now and to get a new skill set so that you can turn into the Clydesdale that you deserve to be? And maybe that's really weird. Maybe you're like, why does this guy keep talking about these weird type of horses that I've never heard about before? But Google them. You'll be really impressed. It's like, oh my gosh, these things are massive. If you ever do decide to travel again, I think that probably the one of the fun things to do in St. Louis is to do a tour of the Budweiser Brewery and get free beer and take your picture with the Clydesdale horses that they still keep on the site. So I think that just realize that you are far more powerful financially than you ever dreamed. Not a lot of people could actually retire in their 50s on a six-figure income. And most of the people that we consult with, the vast majority, in fact, are on pace to do that after our consult, because we show them what's possible when they think of their student loans like an income tax. Or if you want to buy your way out of the income tax, you can pay $3,000 a month with a 3.5% fixed rate for 20 years, right? Because that's a better deal. That's a cheaper deal than losing a percentage of your income because you're making so much relative to your debt. Both of those options are amazing. And it gives you choices in life that if you had $600,000 of debt with $120,000 income and you had to lose $5,000 a month to make your payments, suddenly you don't have any choices. Suddenly you can't have kids on time. Suddenly you can't buy a house on time. The good news is anything that's getting in your way should not be because of student loan debt. So for example, if you are struggling to afford a house in Denver, the student loans are not the reason. It's because the housing market is on fire more than the center of the sun right now. And it's just really difficult to buy a house in a place where everybody and their mother wants to live, like Denver. So that's the reason that you're having trouble financially. It's not because of the student loans. In fact, without the student loans, you wouldn't have that earning potential and you wouldn't have those earning financial muscles that you could even be able to potentially afford a place like that. It's been a really hard time with this pandemic for a lot of people, myself included. I mean, right now I feel a little bit of like sadness and just sort of this weird kind of dull depression of just waiting around for when is my vaccine number going to get called? When is it going to get called for the vulnerable people in my life? When are they going to get scheduled? When am I going to be able to have everyone fully vaccinated so I don't have to feel guilty about traveling all over the place around the country? When are we all going to be fully vaccinated so there's a lot lower chance that we're going to spread anything to my wife's elderly patients? There's so much going on right now, and I don't blame you, but the thing is you are a Clydesdale. You are a powerful person with lots of earning potential. Your educational decision was probably a good one. You should not blame yourself for it. In fact, it's probably something that will enable you to be financially independent sooner rather than later in most cases. And if you are saying, hey, I want my loans optimized so that I pay the lowest amount towards my student loans, make that quote-unquote income tax as low as possible, or I'm not sure if I should treat it as an income tax or a debt, that's where our consulting service is for. And that's why our average Google ranking is like 4.95 or 4.94 or something like that out of 5 stars over like, I think, 800 reviews. You know, go to studentloanplanner.com/help. We're really excited to announce too, we've got 2 new consultants we've added to the team, Dan and Molly. So Dan's a certified financial planner and Molly's a certified financial planner, chartered financial analyst, and MBA. Wow. So they've got years of experience in the financial planning industry. We're working on training them. They're going to be coming live doing consults in the next couple months. But we're really excited to be still here, still around in a year where they paused payments and interest for a year and a half, somehow student loan planner is still profitable enough to keep adding to the team and hiring. And that's because we help you. That's the reason why we exist, is because we help crush your student loan anxiety. And I'm so grateful for that opportunity. And that tells you how bad student loans are, people. If people are still booking us the exact almost normal amount that they would before the pandemic, even though student loan payments and interest are paused for a year and a half, that tells you how much of a damage the student loans can have in somebody's psychology and in their anxiety levels. So realize that with the right set of information, with the right plan, the right student loan plan, student loan debt does not need to hold you back. And before you know it, you're going to be a Clydesdale powerful enough to drag a barn or a gigantic wagon full of beer to Washington to celebrate the end of Prohibition, right? That was the example from earlier. I'm just joking around at this point, y'all. Thank you for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast. And again, if you have any questions you want us to feature in a future show, go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. Take care and have a wonderful week.